Good evening and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Kerry Curtis, Chair of the Club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum and a member of the Board of Governors, and I will be your chair for today's program. I'd also like to welcome our radio audience and remind everyone that you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker this evening is Paul Kephart. Paul is originally from the Midwest, but had the perspicacity as a young man to move to California, and furthermore was so wise as to move to Carmel as a young man, without any coaching from anybody, I gather. Paul is a biologist by training and a restoration ecologist by choice and by deed. Mr. Kephart is executive director of Rana Creek Habitat Restoration and Living Architecture, an ecological design firm founded in 1996 by him, and is the designer of the living roof at the new Academy of Sciences in Golden Gate Park, which is the most well-known and most visited environmental roof in the world. Paul is the leading ecologist and technical design consultant in the field of living architecture, vegetative structures, and sustainable landscapes. His projects include a number of well-known things, including the UCLA Film Library, the Gap Inc. headquarters, a snowmass base village at Aspen, the Vancouver Convention Center, as well as work for Clint Eastwood and David Packard, because that's where the money is. So please welcome Paul Kephart.
Thank you for the warm welcome, and I'm very pleased to be here on Earth Day. I can't think of a more fitting topic than to share with you our experiences of the design work for the California Academy of Sciences Living Roof. This is a spectacular project. It represents the intersection of art and science and architecture. Is that loud enough for you? The project took us nearly 3 years to design and build. I was brought in as an ecologist. I had the idea that we could provide some biodiversity within the heart of Golden Gate Park, mimic, simulate, or replicate one of our native plant communities, the Coastal Bluff. So I'm going to tell you the story of that design and some of the lessons learned along the way, and share with you some of these ideas of this concept or this discipline, this architectural discipline of living architecture, which is essentially that replicating natural processes or simulating natural processes as part of structure. And that's a big differentiation between just amenity and landscape and adornment, that these landscapes function for creatures, butterflies, hummingbirds, and pollinators, and our key focus is on ecology. The Academy is the roof is some 2.2 acres, probably the most challenging vegetated structure in the world, the most green museum in the world, now awarded the honor of being LEED Platinum. The vegetated roof contains 6 inches of growing media, some 1.9 million propagules of plants. The precedence for this work here in California, the phenomena of vegetated rooftops and living roofs, or green roofs as they're called, is not new to Europe. For the past 50 years, the Germans and the Europeans have used these rooftops, sedum roofs. They've taken old buildings and crushed up the brick and taken that media up on top of their roofs and grown sedum carpets to mitigate for site impacts, stormwater mitigation, and also to focus on biodiversity. The technology has been in place for waterproofing and drainage and the system components. And early in the 90s, there was a horrendous heat wave in Chicago, and people died. And as a way in which to mitigate, Mayor Daley said, we're going to end the heat island effect in Chicago, and one of the ways we're going to do that is to vegetate our city. And we're going to target these hot, arid, heinous tar roofs that absorb heat and don't allow it to and reflect that heat back into the environment. And that was an impetus for the rest of the country to get involved. Now, these living roofs in these subarctic climates where we receive summer rainfall, they're fairly straightforward. We've got plenty of rainfall for the plant materials. But as we move west and we're here in the arid west where we enjoy 175 days without any moisture, it's a different system. It's a different story. And we had to adopt our design approach for biodiversity, for ecology, for seasonality, and for our water regimes. So those early precedents, the Post Ranch Inn was one of the first projects I worked at. I was a young ecologist. I worked with Mickey Munich, a wonderful man, have done nearly 9 living roofs with Mickey on a residential scale. Post Ranch was one of the first low-impact developments where he didn't grade and he put the structures on post and beam and raised them through the redwoods. And I was studying Coastal Terrace Prairie as a study for the Nature Conservancy, the prairie being one of our most threatened plant communities. And I said, Mickey, you're going to put these little bungalows right on this little prairie. There's some 247 species of plants that occupy this space. And Mickey said, well, Paul, not to worry. We'll lift up that prairie and we'll put it on top of the roofs. That's the first time I heard that. And then the next time I heard it was a man named Bill McDonough looked me up and he said, Paul, I have a project with the Gap Corporation and I want to build a living roof, a green roof at that time. And I was working on San Bruno Mountain as a restoration ecologist and I needed a way in which I could increase the seed source of particular native grasses that had been expunged in the wild. So I saw this as an opportunity to increase locally adapted site-specific species on top of a controlled environment on a roof. Now, Bill at the time didn't know that or appreciate it, but and this was a courageous project. We had no metrics. We didn't understand how these rooftops would perform. We knew how to build them and construct them, but we really didn't know how they would adapt and perform over time. And I began to model these rooftops by these McCargian environmental factors, slope and aspect and orientation, and look at a plant community approach. And that's what evolved into this science of living architecture, that I was looking at natural processes. And not just the orientation and composition and density and structure of plant materials, but how they functioned and the utility of those plants. On the Gap at that time, we raised up those bioswales and we created constructed wetlands in those swales with wetland plants some 3 stories above the ground. And all of that toxic, volatile, chemically active air pollution, that particulate matter that fell on those swales, was cleaned and polished that water. At that time, though, we took that water and ran it right off the roof and into a stormwater leader, and it went away. So this story is also about the progression of our sustainable design and how that we started with some early concepts, and now when I talk about the Academy and our new projects, this is a focus on integrative and holistic design where we would never allow that precious rainwater to leave the site. So what's that big idea behind the design? I said this at least 10 times today, no potable water for non-potable uses. On all of our projects, we're finding that we can capture and store and reuse the stormwater that falls on the site and the structure, and we have an abundance of water for the landscape irrigation. This is a key driver for water conservation in the state. We also want to think about no potable water for any irrigation, no groundwater and stormwater discharge, We have to get to the point where we're not treating water like waste, that our storm water, our gray water, and our black water can all be treated on site as part of architecture, and it's precious. And when we do that, we look at a net zero use of potable water. The other key factors is to encourage the biodiversity and increase resource efficiencies, and this is when it's time to celebrate. And I'll talk about one of our projects now where these sustainable design elements provide a payback to the developer. It's not enough to tell a developer, together we can save the world. We have to demonstrate that, Mr. Developer, I'm going to give you a return on your investment, and we're going to save the world. Recent studies have shown that green buildings doing the right thing do have a payback, and the systems that we are installing are financially viable. The Academy consisted of about 11 structures. Many of them were obsolete. There were problems seismically, and there was a decision made to look at a new museum. And Renzo's vision was best articulated by these simple abstract drawings that looked at the site in terms of place and looked at the structure in terms of form. And it's true that program and informs architecture, that one of the domes houses the planetarium and the other dome the rainforest exhibit. Renzo was a wonderful man to work with. I continued to dialogue with him about the benefits of biodiversity, the benefits of seasonality, challenging him on the idea of sustainable design, seasonal adaptation of plants, allowing for decadency, dormancy and decay, allowing for plants to go dormant. Renzo would say, well, that's an interesting story, but it has to be beautiful. So that's what Renzo taught me as an ecologist, that we could make these systems work and we could still make them beautiful. And here's the third time I heard that quote about lifting up a piece of the park and placing a building under it. A great team, Chong Partners, Renzo Piano, Overup, SWA, Jensen Landscape were the installers. I think a part of our sustainability is how we work and communicate together. The Academy brought together a wonderful team of collaborators, very creative people that resulted in a wonderful project. From my perspective as an ecologist, I was focused on a few species of butterflies and pollinators. I wanted to build a field of dreams, and I inoculated this rooftop with larval food hosts for bay checkerspot butterflies, and also conducted a study that has now established bay checkerspot butterfly habitat on 6 rooftops throughout the Bay Area, all the way down to the newly constructed, it's being built now, the San Jose Police Station, and these rooftops are within 2 miles of the meta populations of these rare butterflies. So it is a field of dreams. If we build it, will they come? And we looked at specific insects and pollinators and their utilization of the roof. We also wanted to design this to adapt and change over time. Renzo, I asked him, well, Renzo, how long will this building be around? And he said, about 2,500 years. How long will your rooftop be around? And I said, well, it'll look good for the first 400 years. And after that, we might have to do a little reseeding. But we, as an experiment, we're scientists, and we wanted to test our hypothesis. It hadn't been done before, the most challenging vegetated roof in the world. And I wanted to look at soil composition, I wanted to look at plant composition, drainage, all those key elements that you'll see in these pictures. So I started with a fairly rudimentary study on the existing roof and took some plywood and some waterproofing and all the system components, and I thought, well, what effect does aspect, orientation, and slope have on the plant material selection? I got shade, I got wet conditions and dry conditions, and I planted 29 species of plants there. Now, it served as a demonstration model, and it served as a model for the architects to get wrapped their minds around aesthetics and appearance. But for me, it allowed me to monitor the utilization from insects, but also start to get a handle on some of these key how are we going to build it questions, and how are we going to establish this rooftop from either propagules or seed, how are we going to retain soil on these very steep slopes, how are we going to subdrain it. Erosion starts at the toe of a slope and works its way up, so we came up with these bathtub rings of subdrains that would intercept water and convey it laterally. You can imagine that over a 4 to 5 year period, these roots are going to fill up that soil mass and that soil be less pervious and will have runoff, which would contribute to erosion. So these were some key questions. Sometimes you get unexpected results. And I looked at the soil growing media specifications in the industry with a lightweight pumice, and it blew away particle by particle by particle. Now, I was glad I learned that here. And this is why we conduct these experiments and designs, so that we can learn about these different factors. Now, along the way, we wanted to start developing the interpretive information, and probably the most important message that we could come up with is this big idea about biodiversity, and it's so fitting for the Academy, and that they house this wonderful display of creatures under the roof, and that the museum, the exhibit, could be as a part of structure and provide habitat for a full array of species on structure. So the story we began to weave, this tapestry of science and art and ecology, was about the utilization of this roof for local species, the integration of urban ecology, architecture, and site. As a part of our studies, we looked at stormwater runoff. San Francisco has a horrendous problem with our combined system overflow, where we're combining raw sewage and fresh rainwater. We've reached capacity. The PUC is working on a program to reduce that input by 25%, and these roofs capture and store about 70% in their growing media of all that rainfall that falls on the roof during peak flow. That's a real key design question, is how much moisture can we retain in that 6 inches, and in this case, 3.8 million gallons of water annually. And that's one of the reasons we achieved the stormwater credit for LEED. You can imagine the detailing that went into figuring out this watershed approach to these mounds and how we can convey water. And Kong Kyung at Gordon Chong came up with this grid system. And it's interesting from an architectural standpoint, this grid system came from an amenity, from an appearance standpoint, and that it would mimic the streets of San Francisco cross-hatching over the hills. And I thought, what? I'm doing this elegant key lining across watersheds. And yet, as it turned out, that was such an elegant solution because it provided a perfect stratified experimental design. So this roof now can become more than just a rooftop planted, but it provides a perfect experimental design to do replicated trials of plants for, let's say, plants that are going to adapt and volunteers that move in, plants for specific pollinators, rare and endangered plants. So it gave us a canvas to paint on. It gave us a chance to understand those plants and how they perform. This was my original list, and in the mock-ups, I looked at the criteria of cover and survival and utilization. And, of course, the architects had something to say about this, that they wanted plants that were beautiful. And so as they honed in on those plants that got a little brown and scratchy or didn't have exactly the right appearance and color, We've started to limit that plant material not to a community or in a cooperative assemblage as we find in nature, but a plant pallet. It's a word I abhor in the landscape architecture field, that I paint with a palette of colors, but plants grow in cooperative assemblages and communities. There was some tension there during the design, and I'm focusing on biodiversity, understanding that those diverse systems have the most resilience. We understand that biodiversity provides resilience. These plants and their communities, their assemblages, are resilient by the invasion of parasitic organisms. They're also more resilient to climatic change. So that it has to be beautiful. There became this tension between form and function. And I would keep pushing and crowding that envelope and saying, well, let's just let the plants go dormant, and let's let them go to seed, and let's let them turn brown and scratchy. As an ecologist, I understand that the greater amount of ecological function occurs during dormancy and decay, and then things revitalize and regrow. But as landscape architects and as community members, it's a part of this educational process that it's okay. And so the testing criteria looked at that aesthetic as one component, and now we can start to gauge just how far we can push that envelope and how we can define sustainability. I say this because if I'm in Connecticut around Halloween and the leaves fall off the trees and the grass turns brown, things are going to rest. That's dormancy, and that's okay. But here in California, around this time of year, the flowering perennials are losing their color, and the grass is turning brown, and that is not okay. And so there's that tension, I think, of all the lessons learned here and all of the work that I'm doing, as I'm looking for that balance between amenity and function. Good lessons to learn. In terms of LEED, we've got the five credits, the stormwater credit, the innovation credit. Probably the key component for me on this project was that the Academy provided the observation deck. How many have been there? Yeah, and I go up there now, and I'm just like a kid. And it's a sense of wonder. And when the kids are around there looking at all the plants and asking all the questions, I really get enthusiastic. And it really truly is a sense of wonderment. Then it became, you know, some of the fun started to get serious. I had to figure out, and I lay awake at night thinking about holding up all these tons of soil on these curvilinear domes, and how would we do that? So would we advance to another mock-up that really started very steep, and it was the base of the dome. And if you were to track that arc and go halfway up the curtain, that now you can start to understand scale and slope. And this is where it became real. And so we began to look at other ways in which to retain soil, and one of those was a gabion basket. And I'd use these gabion baskets in a key line design on the 5.9-acre Vancouver convention roof. And I simply calculated the runoff. The roof is inclined planes. Slope interrupted that surface flow and subsurface flow to a perimeter drain. That water would go under into a 240,000-gallon bladder that's floating in the ocean and then is pumped up and reused on the roof. So I adopted that gabion for this project, and I also looked at this gabion as a way to retain soil around the skylights, and the skylights being a very critical place of a nick point, if you will, for erosion. But I went back to Renzo's advice. It has to be beautiful. And I just really didn't like how clunky this looked. So we came up with what I called the Victoria Secret solution and developed the underwire so that those And this is an example of how we planted the plants, and we were all the way into design development. We're almost there. I think we're 50% through construction documents when we are doing this. And oh, I learned some more things, that there was a better way of getting the plants up on the roof. I also learned there was a better way of retaining soil. I also learned that waterproofing membrane applications are laid out in 36-inch wide strips. And the manufacturers, the installers, would put their rubberized recycled crumb rubber down as a slurry and lay down their waterproofing. And because it went around in a curve, there were these bird's mouths that would allow for leaks. And then I'd watch them lift that up and essentially pull the waterproofing and ruin the waterproofing as they applied the waterproofing. So a really great quality control was learned from doing this mock-up, and that we then limited the length of run of those sheets in the specification, and that informed the proper manner to waterproof the roof. So great knowledge we gained. And then we also overseeded our wildflower mixes as a nurse crop for erosion control. These are all species that are targeting nectar and pollen food sources. But it was too massive. We learned about seeding rates. This provided too much of that dry, brown, scratchy material at the end of the growing season. It was a beautiful color display, but we honed in on that. Now, this takes time and it takes foresight. And I, as an ecologist and a plantsman, I like things that mature over time. And somebody said, well, Paul, how did you get started in this? And I tell them, with a little handful of seed. And way back when I was helping to restore San Bruno Mountain and other areas around the city, I would collect seed. And I have a library of plants at my nursery, about 400 species. And so I collected and propagated and started with small increases. And over a two-year period, we increased and increased and divided and grew out some 1.9 million propagules of plants for the project. And the only way we could achieve this goal was to start early, plan ahead in order to get that many plants. And then Renzo posed a very fascinating question. And it really has had a profound effect on our horticultural applications and green roof systems. And he said, Paul, can you come up with a way of getting those plants up on the roof without utilizing plastic containers? I said, sure, we can do this. With nursery horticultural trades, we utilize peat. Our growing media, we had modified to use cocoa coir rather than peat. It's the same pH. It's a waste product. And so I started to fashion this tray system called the BioTray, and it's from a waste product in subtropic areas near coral reefs typically, that they're non-regulated big mountains of this stuff that contain high levels of salt. And there's no home for it, and these salts are washing into nearshore estuarian and coral areas. And we put some folks to work creating bio trays. And then the secret sauce is the key ingredient here is mycorrhizal fungi. And we enhanced the performance of the plants and the trays by inoculating the roots and the trays with fungi. The fungi is an organism found in nature, ecto and endo. It enhances phosphorus nutrient uptake, phosphorus being one of our key pollutants that come from the sky. So this also enhanced water quality. And that was the story behind the development of the tray. And as we developed this, we found it a real easy way to transport our diversity of plants in the tray. That's me with a 250-pound stress test to make sure we could walk on the trays. And the establishment and the building and construction of a living roof is complex. There's a lot of parts. It's a product-driven field. Every single manufacturer has their hamburger, and they want you to invest in every single part of it. Our systems today are getting much more simple, but often they are comprised of waterproof membrane, this drainage mat. In this case, it was a reservoir board that would hold about a gallon of water per foot. And we also had to anchor all these systems on the roof. And this is a great illustration on how we tiled the roof with insulation and then overlaid our grid and locked that grid of gabions in place in a sandwich or two layers of insulation. I'm working on the new Miami Science Museum, and their big idea is to develop the most energy-efficient roof in the world. Why do we need insulation if we're putting 6 inches of growing media on, and plant material on a rooftop? Currently, we measure insulative value by resistance, and that conductivity changes when the soil media is wet. So there's a lot of variables to model for us to understand the true insulative value of soil and vegetation. And that's one of our, we're starting our mock-up program now to model roofs without insulation and with insulation. But in this case, our Title 24 doesn't allow us just to use growing media. We have to use insulation. We did so here. But this is an illustration on how we anchored the growing media and the gabions on the domes is that there's belts and suspenders. Those straps that you see growing through the middle of the cells are tied on to the other side of the dome. So if one had to slip, it would have to pull all the weight of the other over the other side of the dome. So that was one of the solutions on how we could anchor those plants. A lot of coordination, irrigation details, drainage details. And as we built it, we continued to test. And we wanted to say, we asked the question, well, what it's going to be like when we move 49,000 bio trays onto this roof? So we simply took some commercial sod and we put them in our trays and we tiled them onto this surface and we looked at, you know, the aesthetic, and we also looked at the how easy it was and how we were going to offset those trays in order to protect from erosion early on while that network of roots and plants got established. Growing media, there's a full science on how we establish the growing media, and ours tend to be high mineral content, lightweight, organic specified growing medias. There's two methods. You can imagine we're getting metric tons of this material, 2-3 stories in the air, and over the top of that roof. One is to bring it in big bags, shipping bags by crane. That's the method we used here. The other is to blow it pneumatically, and there's most of our projects now, we actually have a tender on the ground plane and then blow the roof up, but blow the growing media up on the roof. But a fairly large undertaking to get all that growing media up on the roof. We also developed standards for organic growing media, the first here in California, and also locally minerals and mineral components that are from a 500-mile radius that would qualify for our lead points. And then we used bread. How do you deliver bread? Well, you know, how are we going to get this from Rana Creek? So we looked at bread racks and used that to load onto semis. We used backhauling so we could minimize transportation and energy costs, and then loaded these trays into these lifts. Then the heavy lifting started, and Jensen Corporation did a magnificent job with this daisy chaining and tiling and placing each tray in the cell. Great undertaking. You know, people were tied off. These are very difficult slopes to stand on. And over a period of several weeks, the roof was planted. And I show this just to illustrate how challenging this was from a design standpoint. You can see the transitions around that parapet, all the drainage that had to occur. And as that picture on the upper right, that illustrates the true slope of that roof. And one of the concerns I had when I started to see that was we needed to break that into smaller segments and create more slope breaks and relief for that water to move through. So on that steepest slope above, you know, this is tons of soil above a glass roof piazza, So it was just key that we retain that soil, and we haven't had any soil slippage at all. And high winds and heavy event rains, it's functioning well. So we went from that to that, and it's a marvelous story. It's a wonderful project, and that's the way in which it's transitioning. We worked from that left side of the structure, and that shows how the biotrays were growing. And now when I go up there, the biotrays have done their job, and they've disintegrated. They've turned to organic matter in the soil. They provided this network of mycorrhizal fungi. Roots have penetrated the sidewalls and the bottom surfaces, and you can't really tell they're there. This was early on in the process where we established a nurse crop, and we planted again. We looked at those wildflowers, and we got the seeding mix right because we didn't, over seed with these wildflowers. It was more subtle, and now we have seasonality. There are five species of annuals. I'm really pleased to learn and to help. We've been growing these plants that we've now planted an additional 40 species of plants. So my original goal of biodiversity is that I pounded my chest and beat the table about for so long. We're finally getting there, and the academy is right there. They're planting these. So when you go up around the observation deck, you'll see a host of native species there and just a suite of pollinating insects, just really a beautiful thing. The design team of SWA was just critical in the construction observation. I was just honored to work with them and that team, and we found things and learned things as we went along, and we worked together and created a great project, and that's what it's like today. I'm really pleased to share this with you, but we have more things to do, and we're just on a new path and a journey, and the Academy of Sciences was one step as you think about the progression of our early designs at Post Ranch and then the GAP and how we're starting to think about this idea of no potable water for non-potable applications, the idea of integrated design. Our project with the Miami Science Museum is now taking all water from all the exhibits and biofiltrating them and demonstrating mangrove wetlands as a part of this project that is a spiral that enters oculi around the top of the roof. So it tells the story of water. And all gray water and black water will be treated as a part of these systems. Another wonderful project, the Croton project in New York City, is 9 acres in size. It's a constructed wetland, a croissant that wraps around a three-story hole in the ground, 9 acres. And that hole is capped with a vegetated rooftop. And this is the water treatment that provides 35% of the drinking water to Manhattan. And as a part of the security, protect from terrorism, we've camouflaged that rooftop by incorporating it and integrating it into the park landscape. So there's a driving range for golf and a golf course with these little meandering mounds and then this constructed wetland that tells the story of water. And all the water that goes through the roof recirculates through the nutrient-rich water because we're dealing with golf course performance turf, and how do you treat that water? Those are two examples of projects that integrate this art and science and ecology. But I think for all of us, the key point here is this, the philosophic connection we have to nature. And that's something that's so missing in our urban life, and that's one of the key missions of Rana Creek. It's a key example of what we could accomplish with the Academy. And we're going to further that work with Transbay. Transbay being a living organism that can process all the water, the stormwater from that tower as well as the site, and create a 5-acre park that provides habitat, another point of connection for biodiversity, and a great amenity that brings nature into the city. Now, this CPMC project I worked on today, it's time to celebrate. We're looking at all of the stormwater and the cooling tower blowdown storing that and reusing it, so there'll be no potable water used on five living roofs. And this project is about healing. And we've learned that people heal 35% faster when they're exposed to living vegetation. So, and we're going to provide living vegetation and these healing gardens and accessible 60,000 square feet of accessible nature to people that are in recovery or people that are grieving or people that need that respite and relief and that healing atmosphere. But we're going to do it without using potable water. We're going to retain 25% of all the stormwater. And then it is time to celebrate with this D'Acero project, because in Mexico it's a little easier to get these projects through. And we're taking this 5,000-person new corporate headquarters for D'Acero, all their waste, black water, treated on-site. No big mystery here. You can stick your head in the tank and it doesn't smell. All the gray water and all the storm water. And in this project, we have a $20,000 annual return on the system. And we're saving 1 million gallons of potable water a year. And all of our excess water is being sold to the municipalities to water and establish street trees for shade. So that's when these sustainable systems are really coming of age. It's a new restorative economy. It provides hope and it provides promise. So I really appreciate the opportunity to share this work with you, and keep visiting the Academy and keep supporting living architecture in our city. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our speaker has been Paul Kephart, who is the designer of the living roof at the Academy of Science. And now we have time for a few audience questions, which we're going to take by way of the wireless mic that Ann Clark is passing around. Question right there.
Paul, I'm a docent at the Academy, and one of the things that was always curious to me was why the effluent, especially since it's so highly monitored and has what you might consider a rich effluent in gray or black water, isn't used on the roof, or am I mistaken? Maybe it is.
No, it's not. And I, the reason I told the story of the precedents with the early adopters, the pioneer, the courageous gap project, and this Academy, and then this progression that you've seen, is that 2 years ago we weren't thinking like this. We weren't thinking in terms of these designs. Systems are expensive. We didn't know how to create a financial model. And I think it just illustrates the progression of sustainable design.
And retrofits work.
Retrofits can work. And it's not, for instance, in the city of Tucson, they're mandating gray water systems, mandating city of Tucson on all new residential developments. Can you imagine every home now? And so that's also creating a demand for retrofitting. And so there's absolutely an opportunity to capture this water and reuse this water at a later date.
I had a question about lots of flat rooftops in the city. How easy is it if you've got, you know, what's the load bearing? How complicated is it to do some sort of
pre-roof? First and foremost, we have to make sure that these structures can retain their loads. So we have to have structural engineers, you know, consider and develop the models for those loads. We are getting we just did the project over here at West Elm, the new Williams-Sonoma store in Emeryville. You can get off the highway, and it's right there in this sea of industrial box stores and parking lots, and there's this little postage stamp of life on a rooftop. So we got that roof down to 4 inches and about 38 pounds. That's like a snow load. The new freight and salvage store in Berkeley, we've done 30 since the Academy, and I think this is so cool, is that it became an emblem of what's possible, and now we've designed and or built or helped people design probably 30 projects in this area. And when we look at the whole city, we're working on the Ortega Library with the city. That'll be an educational component that people, the school children, will go to and see the roof. When I worked on the Ballard Library in Seattle, we created a little portal, a parapet that you'd look in the wall, and a periscope, you could see birds up there. A lot of educational opportunities. The city is moving ahead with One Van Ness for stormwater. There's just the community college. So you look at those flat roofs, there's a lot of possibility. And I did an analysis that we could solve our stormwater dilemma once and for all with 21 acres of roofs. So we only have about 17 more acres to go in San Francisco. And we could solve our water dilemma if we just harvested the water off of the roofs.
Right. So is there a plan of the supervisor for the city?
Well, I can't do it all. You've got to have some help.
Paul, we were on the roof not long ago and heard someone comment that the non-native plants that had immigrated into the park with the help of humans were actually now native plants in the sense that they are now immigrating up to the roof.
Uh-huh.
And I wondered if you had heard anything about that.
I love this conversation because, there's always a schism between, the native plants versus non-native plants and what's native and what's not. And in modern ecology, we just consider these volunteers. They're just fulfilling a niche. They're utilizing a resource not otherwise available. I think there's 175 non-native species just in the bay. So I asked the question because I want to set the right expectation for people that are building roofs. How many of these plants naturalize? And I don't call them weeds, I call them volunteers because they have some function. They're fulfilling a niche and they provide some seasonal flowers and they have pollinators and food and cover. They're my friends. I'm not going to, not all of them are bad guys. So
you're not going to kick them off the roof.
Well, I went from Southern California on all my projects all the way up. This was a tough job, but I had to do it all the way to Victoria, Canada. And I got on my hands and knees and I studied on my hands and knees 14 rooftops. And I did the Seattle Justice Department, the City Hall, the Ballard Library, the Gap, the White Rock, all the projects, and I found something interesting. 87 species of plants volunteered on rooftops. Vascular plants, mosses, bryophytes, protozoans, got them all. 37 species were found on every single roof. Oh, interesting. Now I call my friend Stefan Bernayazin in the University of Basel, Switzerland. He's a professor of biology. 20 of those plants are ubiquitous on his roofs. And so it helps us understand the ecology of living roofs, that they're living, they're not green all the time, and they adapt and perform by site conditions. And there's some factors at play with the distribution, the universal or the circumpolar distribution of plants and their adaptation to these ruderal landscapes, the crack in the sidewalk. When I designed the rooftop for the Gates Foundation, you'll love this story. The Gates Foundation wanted to build a living roof on a parking structure. And I said, okay, I'm going to go. I did these big soil tests, and I had all these trays lined out and replicated trials to look at organic content with soil. It's a big industry debate. And I said, well, I want to, and they had the landscape architects wanted to simulate or mimic a wetland, seasonal wetland system by planting one species of red sedum and one species of green sedum, and then plant little white flowers that would come up to simulate the birds. I think they used the word evoke. And I thought, how sad. I mean, why don't we just create the wetland on top of the roof and have real birds? But one of the things I did to set that right expectation that, yes, you're going to have volunteers, yes, it can get brown and scratchy and still function, is I went with my pocket knife and I picked out of the sidewalk cracks every single volunteer I could find in a 2-mile radius, and I planted that in a model and said, here's your red sedum and here's your green sedum, and then, just for fun, as we're looking at this, here's a native plant assemblage, And then here's what I call your ecological roof, the roof you're going to end up with if you never watered it and you never weeded it and you never maintained it. And it was interesting. They actually liked it the best. So we will see. I think the Academy now has some plots to look at volunteer species and what actually naturalizes.
Any other questions?
Good questions. Yeah.
Could you just comment for a moment on the local news here had to sell papers or something? So they had a story about irrigation on the roof. Well, obviously, in terms of seeding, there is. But could you just address that?
Well, I didn't see the article, but the writer did call me, and I'll tell you all what I told him, is that the Academy is right on track. We wanted to establish the roof with a large percent of cover and root development. We developed a watering regime so that could happen. Now, and also the roof is zoned, so now experimental. I mean, this is testing and rigor that we can begin to back off on water. We can increase water. We can look at response. We can look at plant performance. We can look at aesthetics. So I'm happy to say that the Academy is right on track with the establishment period, and now is the time to go forward and look at the other water use criteria.
Thank you.
Yep. So thank you all. I'm really happy to be here to share this story.
I actually had a question, Paul, and that was when I look at all the flat roofs, you know, if you look in the industrial parts of Oakland and other cities, you see acres and acres and acres of flat roofs, warehouses, factories, and so forth. When I see that, I see I see solar panels there generating electricity. When you look at it, you probably see a sea of living roofs. Are we going to get to a point where there's a conflict between the usage of flat roofs?
Well, you know, you guys couldn't ask better questions for me. Because our designs now is an integrated approach. We combine solar, wind, vegetation, and water so that we get all of these as part of an integrated design process. Solar energy is 35% more effective on a cool roof because there's less ambient heat. So it operates more efficiently. When I see solar collectors, I see water collection devices. I can increase the amount of water I can capture and store by diverting that water and using the solar as water collecting devices. My next invention I'm working on is a roof tile that actually is a water collecting, solar energy generating, combined with plant material and light well structure.
Good grief. Can I buy shares in that venture? All right. Our speaker has been Paul Kephart, the designer of the living roof at the California Academy of Sciences. And our program, the Commonwealth Club of California, observing its 105th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.